Today is Friday, February 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, as the COVID-19 coronavirus spreads, fears grow that it could hit a refugee camp.
I would find it difficult to say at the moment everything is done properly to prevent it. Yeah, this would be probably too positive.
Plus, the U.S. and the Taliban are expected to sign a peace deal tomorrow after 19 years of war. And Ankara calls for a no-fly zone in Syria after an airstrike killed 33 Turkish soldiers. Those stories and more are next. Our top story today. As of Friday, there were more than 83,000 coronavirus cases worldwide and more than 2,800 deaths. Most of the cases are in China, where the number of new cases has dropped. China's National Health Commission reported 327 new cases and 44 deaths early Friday, the lowest number of new cases in more than a month. But in South Korea, the hardest-hit country outside China, cases surpassed 2,000 with 256 new cases and 13 deaths. Most of the cases are in Daegu, South Korea's fourth-largest city. At least 40 countries are reporting the virus, with some new cases in new places. Mexico, New Zealand, Nigeria, Lithuania, and Estonia have all now reported the virus within their borders. In the U.S., officials are reporting the first coronavirus case of, quote, unknown origin, end quote, meaning the female victim in Northern California did not travel outside the U.S. or come in contact with anyone who was known to be infected. And in Switzerland, the Geneva Auto Show was canceled after the Swiss government put an immediate ban Friday on all public and private events involving more than 1,000 people to limit the spread of the virus. As COVID-19 spreads around the world, aid workers fear the worst if the virus hits a major refugee camp in Africa, the Middle East, or in Southeast Asia. In many camps, thousands of people are packed together with poor sanitation facilities. To find out more about preparations to protect refugee camps, I spoke earlier today with Dr. Tancred Stube of Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF. Dr. Stube recently spent 4 weeks in Southeast Asia assessing preparedness and helping train health workers, including at the Cox's Bazar refugee camps in Bangladesh, where nearly a million Rohingya refugees have fled from neighboring Myanmar. Here's what he had to say about the risk of COVID-19 for refugees.
I would be quite concerned because people living in those very often crammed camps, their immune capacity is low. So they usually they have to deal with a lot of diseases anyway. Their health isn't in a particularly strong state. And of course, and we looked specifically at Cox's Bazar because MSF, we are quite heavily involved in there. So we made sure that we have an intensive care unit there prepared so we can isolate people and can put them there also on ventilation machine if it comes to the worst thing. But the most important thing would be to really prevent that to happen, because every refugee camp means there are thousands of people involved. And once an outbreak with corona would be inside a camp, it would be very, very difficult to handle, because you can't prevent the further spread. It is everywhere. And people are vulnerable. Their health status is impaired. So first priority is to prevent it to getting there in the first place.
And so can you talk a bit about what are the things that should be done to prevent it from getting there in the first place?
One important element is to check the borders, to check the major hubs. That means airports, border places. Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh is close to the Myanmar border, and Myanmar itself has a land border to China. Fortunately, those ways sort of from China all the way to Cox's Bazar is not an easy way for traveling. So at the moment, we know that overseas travelers are at a big risk of transmitting the disease. So making sure that everyone who enters the camp will be screened, that if there is a suspicious case, that we find very quick ways to make the diagnosis. If that diagnosis turns out positive, to isolate that person, treat accordingly, but make sure that a further spread inside a camp would be prevented. So making sure that at the entrances of the gate, we have a good screening system, a triage system in place to make sure that if there's a sick patient, we can separate them from the healthy ones.
Is there enough attention? Is there enough being done right now to prevent this coronavirus from entering into refugee camps? Are the global health authorities and different agencies, are they taking this seriously enough and doing enough?
The trouble is that just in the last few days, we have seen many more countries being affected by the outbreak. So yes, we need to be concerned that also in those poor countries, and that's not to be forgotten, more than 80% of all refugees in the world are hosted by resource-poor countries. Usually those refugee camps are at land borders, but they are not usually close to big airports. Yeah? So this is a little sign of hope. I think we have to be very cautious at the moment because we know that those people living in those very, very precarious situations will be affected. We know also now corona cases have been found in Africa. I would find it difficult to say at the moment everything is done properly to prevent it. Yeah, this would be probably too positive. You know, we see a lot of countries having good protocols in place now, but to have a good protocol somewhere on written, yeah, doesn't help. We need to implement it. We need to make sure that our medical staff on the ground exactly know how to implement that, to have a step-by-step approach, what to do when they see a suspected case, how they do the diagnosis, how to separate them, and have that all in place. That's crucial. It's not enough to have a good protocol somewhere in headquarters, in a ministry. It needs to be on the ground where the people are affected.
That was Dr. Tancred Stube of Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF. In Afghanistan, the reduction of violence agreements between the U.S. and the Taliban is largely holding, and Afghans are getting a first glimpse of what a peace deal between the U.S. and the Taliban would look like. After nearly 19 years of war, the two groups are expected to sign a peace deal on Saturday at 2 p.m. local time in Doha, the capital of Qatar, where for the last 18 months, the two sides have been holding grueling negotiations. VOA's Afghanistan and Pakistan Bureau Chief Ayesha Tanzim is in Doha covering the talks and gave me an update earlier today.
The Afghan government announced that it has sent six people to Doha to talk to Taliban about prisoner relief. The Taliban have denied that, and the people here in Doha, it is not clear whether they will meet the Taliban or whether they will not meet the Taliban.
And that prisoner release, is that something that could potentially delay this process further, or is that something that is kind of last-minute shuffling of the chairs, but the peace deal is expected to go through anyways?
So this whole process has two steps. The first step is the deal between the U.S. and Taliban, and that is at this point a done deal. The Taliban have agreed, the U.S. has agreed, both sides have announced. Media from around the world is arriving in Doha. Diplomats from around the world are arriving. The Qatari government is hosting the ceremony. So that deal is going to be signed. The second step of that is within 10 days of signing the deal, there's supposed to be the start of another negotiation, this time between Taliban and a representative team of other Afghans. That team of 15, 20 people is supposed to have members of government, opposition, women, human rights activists, etc. That process can be delayed, not just because of this prisoner release back and forth, but also because there's a political crisis in Kabul after the presidential election. Two candidates both declared victory. That political crisis is going to make it difficult to form a team of Afghans that all sides is okay with and finds it represents them. So the first step is going to happen tomorrow. The second step, yes, could be delayed.
And that second step, that's the intra-Afghan dialogue. Is that correct?
Yes, the second step is the intra-Afghan dialogue, and many observers say that is going to be the more complicated one, and a lot of people have said that is where the real work will have to be put in. Now, the U.S.-Afghan negotiation was complicated, but at least both sides agreed on the outcome, which is Taliban wanted U.S. to withdraw its forces, and U.S. wanted to withdraw U.S. its forces under the right circumstances. In the intra-Afghan, both sides disagree on what the future of the country should look like. So on one hand, we have Taliban who want an Islamic system, and they do claim that they believe in women rights and human rights, but their definition of what those rights are is much different from how human rights activists or women's rights activists in Afghanistan define those rights for themselves. So there's going to be a more complicated negotiation, not to mention that there's going to be some kind of power sharing, because, of course, the Taliban are not going to just simply give up everything for nothing. There might be an insistence on changes in the Afghan constitution. Nobody knows for sure what the future of Afghanistan looks like. So that's going to be the hard work that needs to be put in, and that all sides are expecting will start this month, fingers crossed.
Going back to the deal between the U.S. and the Taliban, after the signing on Saturday, then what are the next steps for implementing that deal?
What is expected is within the first few months of the deal signing, the U.S., which has 13,000 soldiers in Afghanistan right now, will bring the number down to 8,600. However, the U.S. has made it very clear that a lot depends on implementation of everything on the ground. What the Taliban have promised is counterterrorism guarantees. They've said that they will work with the U.S. to keep Al-Qaeda at bay and ISIS at bay, Islamic State at bay. Now, Islamic State has claimed several attacks in Afghanistan during the last 1 week, which was supposed to be a reduction in violence week when both the U.S. and Taliban were, and the Afghan security forces were all holding their fire. So the counterterrorism part of it and how both sides cooperate on that, that will determine what happens after the U.S. reduces its forces to 8,600. President Trump recently said in India that from that point onwards, a lot of other things will determine how the rest of the reduction happens. The Taliban have said that their deal is that the U.S. will withdraw all its forces. However, we have not seen the deal. We don't know if there's a timeline, but we do know, as President Trump said, that things will be interlinked.
That was VOA's Aisha Tanzim in Doha. Hong Kong police Friday arrested three prominent Hong Kong pro-democracy activists, including media mogul Jimmy Lai, on charges of illegal assembly. Lai, an outspoken critic of Beijing, and two other pro-democracy activists were charged for having taken part in an August protest march. Lai, who did not speak to reporters when he was released later in the day, is said to have been a target of criticism by Chinese state media. Former legislators Yi Chukyan and Yung Sum were also arrested on the same charges. Police say all three are due in court May 5th. U.S. stocks fell sharply Friday and were on track for their worst week since October 2008, as the spreading coronavirus threatens to derail the global economy. The virus outbreak has been shutting down industrial centers, emptying shops, and severely crimping travel all over the world. More companies are warning investors that their finances will take a hit. You're listening to VOA News. Despite no fresh violence in the last 3 days in New Delhi, the death toll from anti-Muslim riots that took place earlier this week in the Indian city rose to 41 as wounded people succumbed to their injuries. There remain about 300 people in hospitals. For more on how Muslims and Hindus in India are recovering from the worst sectarian clashes in India in years, and how India's ruling BJP party is responding, earlier today I spoke with journalist Anjana Pasrika in New Delhi.
Security was kept up today for Friday prayers to ensure trouble did not flare again, and armed police are still patrolling the area. Even drones were deployed to monitor the situation. A lot of arrests have been made in recent days to ensure that the situation is brought under control.
Now, that sounds like a change from before. The police previously had been accused of letting the riots happen and not really intervening.
Absolutely. The police have come under very heavy criticism for not preventing the riots from taking on this very serious turn and allowing 48 hours of systematic looting and arson to take place by both Hindu and Muslim groups. In fact, we had to have the National Security Advisor, who actually stepped in on Tuesday evening, the worst day of the riots, and who took direct charge of the situation to bring it under control.
How are communities doing in the aftermath? Obviously, there has been not only the injuries and the death toll, but destruction to shrines, to mosques, to shops, to houses. How are people recovering and picking up the pieces?
You know, it is going to take people a lot of time to rebuild their lives because the riots have virtually devastated what is essentially a working class neighborhood. Many people here have small businesses, small shops, etc. And as you said, many of these are destroyed. Homes have been damaged or burnt. Some schools in the area were also attacked, furniture burnt. So there are questions about how students will resume studies. Many families have even fled the area, and many still say they are too scared to step out of their homes. So you don't actually see a lot of people out in the streets as yet.
And what does this mean for the communities themselves? Obviously, India is an incredibly diverse country, although there have been numerous instances of sectarian violence in the past. Hindus and Muslims still do live together. What is this doing to these communities? Are the Hindu and Muslim communities in New Delhi now very, very far apart, or is there a chance for some kind of reconciliation?
I think there is a chance for reconciliation because, as you say, people sort of live together in these neighborhoods. In fact, in this particular neighborhood also, you had a lot of Hindus and a lot of Muslims. And in the aftermath of the riots, we have had a lot of good stories also coming out of people from one community sheltering those of the other community, offering food, offering home, saving them from the rioters, doing something to step up, trying to get a mob to go away. For example, a Hindu or a Muslim would allow, right, get a Muslim mob to go away or a Hindu. So a lot of good stories coming in. As I guess in any rioting situation, it is not ordinary people who are really responsible for it. A lot of criminal elements are supposed to have actually entered, provided the guns, the sticks, the stones which were hurled at each other. So hopefully in the long run, there will be rebuilding, there will be trust reestablished. Though, of course, at this point of time, there is still a lot of fear.
Now, last of all, looking politically, there's been an uptick in anti-Muslim violence in particular in India under the administration of Prime Minister Modi. What politically do these riots mean, and has his government come out and credibly condemned them or credibly taken action to repair this damage?
A lot of the polarized atmosphere, which is supposed to have actually led to the riots, has been created by a new citizenship law that was passed in India recently and which Muslims are protesting. The citizenship law excludes Muslims from immigrants who will be granted nationality from three neighboring countries, and they worry that this is a threat to their citizenship. The government, of course, has repeatedly said it does not threaten any Indian Muslim at all, but it hasn't allayed their concerns. However, the government simply says that the protesters are misled, and the Home Minister, Amit Shah, who is the number two man in the government today, actually accused opposition parties of misleading those who are protesting this law and creating this polarized atmosphere. Many analysts, however, say that the riots were fueled, actually, because of hate speech by members of the ruling party against the protesters, which we have heard a lot of in the last 2 months. In fact, it was comments by a leader of the BJP warning protesters to vacate a road in the riot-affected area, which is supposed to have acted as a trigger for the violence.
That was journalist Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi, India. Turkey announced a revised death toll of 33 Friday from the Thursday airstrike by Syria's government in the war-torn Idlib region. VOA's Ayan Bior has the details.
Turkey Friday called for an international no-fly zone in Syria to protect hundreds of thousands of civilians from government forces' airstrikes in the Idlib region. The proposal came hours after Syrian government forces carried out an airstrike, killing 33 Turkish soldiers in northeast Syria. NATO country ambassadors held emergency talks at the request of Turkey, a member of the alliance. Turkey also announced that refugees could gain access to Europe through Turkey. Turkey's security forces have been ordered not to stop the exodus, at least temporarily reversing an arrangement made with the EU in 2016. Turkey shares borders with two European Union countries, Greece and Bulgaria. Greek police reinforcements were deployed to the country's border checkpoints with Turkey on Friday to prevent migrants entering Greece. Greek police buses were seen preventing access. Meanwhile, Bulgaria's defense minister said Friday they were sending 1,000 extra troops to its border with Turkey to prevent illegal migrant inflows. Krasimir Karakachanov said border police had prevented two groups of about 30 people from entering Bulgaria from Turkey on Friday, About 1 million Syrian refugees have been displaced and have gathered near the border with Turkey since December.
That was VOA's Ayan Bior. For more on the latest developments on the Syrian border with Turkey, VOA editor Kate Pound-Dawson spoke with Dorian Jones, a journalist in Istanbul who has been closely following the story.
Well, Turkish forces have been pounding Syrian regime targets all across this Idlib province, which is the center of fighting between the regime and rebels, Syrian rebels, their last main stronghold. The Turkish Defense Minister, Hulusi Akar, said that they had hit over 200 targets, claiming to have killed hundreds of Syrian regime soldiers, tanks, helicopters, and they said they are now assessing the effectiveness of those attacks before deciding further steps. At the same time, Turkey has been looking to its Western allies. It's been calling for the creation of a no-fly zone over this Idlib province. The reason why that is seen as so important because at the moment, Russian jets have been acting with impunity along with Syrian regime forces against the rebels and Turkish forces. And Turkey has not been able to enter Syrian airspace because of the presence of Russian forces and a missile system. Now, Ankara is looking to its NATO allies, and in particular to Washington, to possibly to deploy a U.S. Patriot missile system on the Syrian border, which would then create clear the skies, as it were, and provide this vital protection for Turkish forces at the moment, who are suffering so badly from these air attacks. Now, it has to be said, what we understand is the message from NATO and from Washington is that, yes, we support you, yes, we understand your predicament, but there is little support for the idea of deploying forces on the ground that could ultimately come into confrontation with Russian forces. And that is causing a great disappointment in Ankara. And at the same time, President Erdogan has been speaking to the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. Those two leaders have agreed to meet at some point. And the outcome of that meeting, if it does occur, is seen as key to the future of this crisis and possibly the ultimate end of the Syrian civil war and how that will end.
Now, what is the situation for the refugees on the Syrian side of the border with Turkey? What's going on there, and what is Turkey's concern about the refugee situation?
Well, and the reason why Turkey has deployed forces, military forces, into the Syrian Idlib province is because to prevent a new exodus of refugees into Turkey. Turkey fears that possibly 1 million, maybe 2 million refugees will ultimately enter Turkey if Damascus overruns its last enclave, which is a home to over 3 million people, the majority of which are women and children. Now, Turkey says we have 3.5 million refugees already in Turkey from that Syrian civil war. We can't take any more. And that is why Turkey has made this quite dramatic move. It says it's now opening its borders to all refugees in Turkey to go into Europe because it says it can't take any more. It feels it's not getting support from Europe. And now it says that the situation that Turkey faces, it should be the problem of all of Europe.
What's Europe's reaction been to that position on the refugees?
Well, I think it's a great deal of alarm. Turkey's neighbors, Greece and Bulgaria, have been ramping up security forces to protect their long borders with Turkey. Bulgaria apparently is sending soldiers. So that gives you an indication of the rising tensions and rising concerns because both those countries will be aware of the risk of another major exodus of refugees into their countries. This happened a few years ago. It caused chaos for those countries and for wider Europe. And ultimately, the fear of a new refugee crisis has been Turkey's main card over Europe. It is now deciding to play that card.
That was journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul, speaking with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson. Somali troops clashed with a regional militia on Friday in one of the most serious outbreaks of fighting yet over political rivalries in the Horn of Africa country. 11 people were killed in the violence, witnesses said. Tension spilled over on Thursday evening between the Somali National Army and the Alusuna Waljamaa militia. That militia is a group of moderate Sufi Muslims, which has played a key role in the fight against the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab insurgency. That's going to do it for us today. You have been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, PJ Elliott, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.